Access number 27783, Mr. Doug Radcliffe, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about a typical raid when you're based at Caravan and operating over, mainly over Italy, Sicily as well, but mainly over Italy by this time. And in particular, the ones you went with Squadron Leader Richard rather than the ones with a bad navigator, or the navigator was having difficulties. Now, you're dropping the bombs. Well, did they take photographs?
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that. Who would do that, and what was the purpose?
That was automatic. They would just be taken by automatic. As the bombs dropped, also a photo flash would go, and it would take pictures of the target area.
Now, you're just showing me a couple here, and you can see that you are quite low. That's not that high. That's 8,000 to 9,000 feet. San Giovanni raid.
Yeah.
And
there's one at 7,000 feet there.
So that's the level you were bombing at.
Yeah, yeah.
And you take photographs. Was the photographs are to what? Recall that you'd done what you were supposed to, or were they to actually see the damage?
Well, not only that. I mean, it was a combination of to get a good photograph of the area, to know exactly what you were up to, what you were doing, and how much damage had been done to the area that you were attacking.
Now, so when you dropped your bombs, what happens then? You're still flying on your own.
Yeah. Oh yes. You don't see any. You'd see. You would sense there were other aircraft around because you'd see their bomb patterns going down. Okay. And if you were all right, you would all be there about the same time. And then you would fly a course back.
Now, anything about the return flight? Still the same vigilance?
Absolutely, yeah.
But any other changes, anything on in the return?
No, exactly the same, exactly the same.
Would you take any food or drink, for the flight?
Yeah, you'd take your own water bottle, and you'd also take other people's, which was frowned upon. We were told not to do it.
Just water?
Well, you take the ground crew would give you their water bottles, okay, which in the moment is warm water, and you take it and lay it on the bed. There's a bed called the navigator's bed in the Wellington, and you get about 10 or 15 bottles up there. And in the morning, you could give the boys their bottle, and it's ice cold. And I think the intelligence...
So it's warm when you got it on the plane, but...
Ice cold when it came down. And the intelligence officer said, it's got to stop. We heard about it. Because one of you go down, there are 10 boys down here without water, without bottles at all, you know. So that was frowned upon.
So it wasn't for you to drink on the flight, it was for them to drink when you got back?
Oh, yeah. But I always used to take a couple of bottles up for myself, just leave them there, and that was marvellous.
What about if you wanted to go to the loo on the flight? I know people are always fascinated by that sort of thing. I mean, would you just wait or would you...
No, there was an Elsan down the end.
A what?
Elsan, E-L-S-A-N.
What's that?
There was a little bucket, okay, with a strap over the top, and you just open it, have a pee, and then put it back on. Easy in the Middle East, difficult flying over England.
Why?
Because your gear is totally different. You're at 22,000 feet. You to undo all this lot.
All the buttons on your equipment, yeah.
Absolutely, it's a bit of a drama. But, most...
Was it mainly just people going to for a wee? There weren't people who had to do anything else?
Well... Yeah.
You had to do what you had to do.
Whatever. Oh, yeah.
Anything else about the flights back?
No.
Now, tell me about this risk. Was it a particular risk of German fighters over the landing ground, or was it?
Well, that is always. That was always a risk, particularly out in the Middle East, because they were so aware of the landing grounds where you were. Because they'd used them. They were their landing ground until we took them from them. They knew exactly where we were. And they would attack. But most of the attacks, fortunately, were on the ports, Bizerte, Sousse, around there. So they, Tripoli, they didn't really attack the aerodromes, but...
I should have asked. It's near Tripoli, is it, Kerouan?
Well, we've got all those areas around there. Sousse, we were very near Sousse, because you could go into Sousse. That's where the airborne divisions took off from.
And what about the landing? Anything special about that?
No.
Did you feel good? You said it was better than the takeoff. Did you feel?
Yeah, we've done the trip. You've done that part of the trip. You've done what you set out to do. Now your job is to get back safely. Okay? And one night we landed somewhere else. It was a grotty, dirty, filthy, sandy, windy night. And Baxter Rese, he's got his first name now. Bax, when we landed, it was a bumpy old landing, and I remember him saying nothing. He said, "Get us out, I got some of you guys strapped in," he said. That was it, you know. We never strapped ourselves in, you know. I don't ever remember doing it. But he said that. Marvellous man.
Now, what about what they call personal morale or moral fibre or whatever? How were you with your nerves? Did you suffer from nerves? Were you nervous? Or did you get more edgy, less edgy? Because some people get very confident, other people get more nervous. How were you in yourself as you flew mission after mission?
What I didn't like was I'd flown some trips with Hadley, and I started to fly, and here would be a crew fresh out from England whose wireless op was sick, and I would be flying with them, and they would be talking to me like an old veteran. What's it like? And I thought, that I didn't like. Here I'm going on a... And Riche said, you know, he said, I said, "You're going back, we're going to I said, "We," plural, okay? I said, "We're going to transfer to Halifax's when we get back, sir." He said, "We are, not you." He said, "You're tourist bird." He said, "That's it, finish." He says, "You're flying with just David, Tom, Dick and Harry until you flew with me." He was a marvellous chap. And, you know, I mean, those words, Peter, I'm still alive. Because had it not been for him, I could have gone back and I might be buried in Germany along with Neville Hadley and Frank Hennessy. Because they hadn't done very many trips when we were grounded. They didn't get the opportunity to fly with other crews. So consequently, they came back, both went on the different squadrons, and with 2 weeks of each other were dead.
Now, so you didn't finish early, you just flown flights with other people?
Yeah.
Now, did you get nervous? It's a difficult question to answer, I know, but I mean, how nervous, it's difficult to quantify, but how did you feel in yourself when you were going up? When you were going up with Richie, you know, a pilot you liked.
Oh, no problem at all. I never felt anything but so secure with him, to be with the crew, not just him. You can imagine the crew he had settled around him. He had a crew that was very experienced. All of these chaps, by the way, that I flew with had flown over Germany. I hadn't. They had flown over Germany. So to fly with that type of experience, you know, and to see the discipline and the silence.
Now, what about, so you land, what happens after landing? Any checks or things you have to do, or can you just get off?
Well, you have a lot to check. You've got to check your trailing aerial. The wireless op's got an aerial, okay, that he trails out to give him a better signal when he's transmitting and picking up and receiving. So you've got to check that aerial is still with you. You land, you know, is it in? So you check the trailing aerial, you check your bits and pieces and switch off, make sure everything's off, and get out of the aircraft and wait for the van to pick you up.
Was there a formal debriefing?
Yeah, but in many cases it was more of the pilots and the bomb aimers. The wireless operator would possibly be asked by the signals officer, "Everything all right?" And that would be the end of that. That was it. Nothing.
And that would be it, would it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Would you get a breakfast, the old bacon and
egg? No.
Nothing
nothing. No.
And then what would you do for the rest of the day if you'd flown a flight that night?
Sleep. Get under the mozzie net and have a good old sleep. That was it, you know.
Now, what were conditions like in the tents? You were at Was it a tented accommodation in Karawan?
All tented. Yeah.
And what were conditions like in the tents?
It was, how can I put it? It was what you made it. I can remember when they came out and we were the three Canadian squadrons. When they came out, they were dubbed Empire Builders by the other old-fashioned squadron. Take 37 Squadron, for instance. They lived a life almost like Arabs. They were so skilled at living out there. They'd been out there yonks, you know.
So what could you do to improve conditions in your tent? What did you do?
Well, we had a cut-down tent. You had a choice. If you put your tent on the ground, you were on the ground. And if you were attacked, you had no real shelter, you know. So if you cut a deep square and set your tent into that, you had a safety area.
From blast?
Yeah, but you also had little friends that may visit you, like asps and scorpions, so you had a little choice to make, you know. But the good friend...
How many were there in your tent? Was it you, just two of you or one of
you? Just two of us, yeah.
And was it stuffy in there?
Well, you're out in Africa, and you know the weather is pretty grim. You know, sometimes you get a lot of rain, and that is filled up. We only had one cam sim, as it's called, or the rain and the wind and the dust to scrub the operation. You know, they couldn't even debrief it, couldn't get the maps out. But that was unusual. But you made.
So, what else would you do to make your tent better, or life in the tent better?
Well, you made it comfortable, for instance. Well, you make sure that the palliasses were aired and cleaned. Okay, you left those out in the sun and nothing would survive there, so you've got no reason. You give it a good old banging. And then you had your sheet, and you'd wash your own pyjamas if anybody went in a pyjamas. Not many did, you know. So your washing facilities were limited because of the water you had. You know, you only got so much water.
Was there a real water shortage? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, no difficulty of water shortage, but of getting it to you. You know, they had these big tanks that would come round, but everybody suffered differently. I still say that the information we got from the old boys of 37 Squadron, they would come over and give you all the tips and all the helpful bits and pieces, you know, they would. You know, you got a shirt that started to disintegrate because of perspiration, you know. You didn't throw that shirt away, you wrapped it around your water bottle. And that insulated it, you know, so you see water bottles that fat.
8-10 inches there.
That kept the water in there cool.
And what about the food? What were the food arrangements out there?
Well, you had a cook, and I once period I shared a billet with him, and because I'd been in Africa some time, I picked up enough Arabic to be able to ask for simple things, and the Arabs would come to the edge of the aerodrome bartering pullets and eggs and their type of bread, and all they wanted was old bits of clothing, and I mean old bits of clothing. They think we've got a sock with a bloody great hole in it, they'd be quite happy to have it. And I would put these, Wally would put these pullets in a mosquito net outside and leave them there for some time and feed them up from scraps from the net until such time he decided to eat them. And I remember one night, I think the officers wanted to know about it, could we get some? And I said, well, you have to wait till we feed them up. They're pullets, little tiny damn things, you know, with no meat on them.
And what about what you got from the army, well, the RAF? What were the basic rations like?
Well, there was always, everything was canned. Everything, you know, everything you got came out of a can, had to, you know, but I found that it was quite reasonable. I ate and enjoyed the food we got given.
And you got enough, basically?
Oh, yeah, there was nothing, no shortage.
Now, any particular mission you remember, or were they, broadly speaking, as much as it can be, an active service routine, in the sense that you weren't attacked by a German fighter, yeah, and you weren't hit?
Yeah, I would
heavy
say
anti-aircraft fire.
They were routine as far as I was concerned, except for that first night where it was very, very dangerous.
Well, and that was before you were with Richard.
That was
the invasion of Sicily.
That was Hadley. Yeah.
July 10th.
Everybody suffered that night, not just us. You know, that when we got back, we talked amongst ourselves. We realised it was just a murderous night, just for everybody, army, navy, and everybody. You know, it was a night that was bit of a game.
Now, so anything else before you move on to what happened next?
No, I don't think of anything. On the Samaria, we all came back, all the squadrons, all the Canadians.
When did you come back then? Looks like, is it August? Were you with Pendro on?
Oh, that's at Milham.
At Milham, and you're back there by the 1st of 44.
Yeah.
So it's a bit unclear as to when you actually come back.
I'll give you the date.
You're doing operations until August.
Yeah. I'll give you the date. I've got it here somewhere. I think we were hanging around in North Africa for at least a month before we got on the Samaria to come back.
So you stopped flying in August.
Yeah.
And then you came back round about. And then what happened when you came back? Was there a period of leave before your next posting?
Yes, there was. Yeah. I think I've got 14 days leave before I went up to Milham.
Now, what was this posting at Milham? What were you doing there?
I was now what they call a screen, and that means you're instructing others.
And what was the name of the thing? It didn't say here.
2AFU, OAFU, 2OAFU.
OAFU standing for?
Observer, Observer, OAFU, Advanced Flying Unit.
And that was at Milham?
Milham, Cumbria.
Now, you were acting as an instructor, a wireless instructor or a gunnery instructor?
Wireless.
Now, how did you feel about this posting? Some people don't like being instructors.
Well, I was naturally surprised that I wasn't sent to a squadron, but obviously Baxter Richet decided that I would be, as they call, tour expired, perhaps for the abnormality of what I was doing. Certainly
you hadn't flown that many op- I mean you've
no.
flown a lot but
yeah.
you
no,
had,
I could
it
have
looks, it looks to me like about 15 or 20, you know.
Yeah.
I've
put it this way, Peter. I would have normally spent 250 operational hours or 30 operational flights, whichever came first, and I was far from that. Okay.
It seems to be 78 hours operational flights.
Yeah. And
so
you are talking a lot shorter. Okay.
So
when I got there, I was very surprised that I was there. Very surprised.
Did you mind, or were you relieved? I mean, you know,
Well, I lost contact with everybody. That was the first thing. I didn't have a crew. I'm now coming into another rather responsible job. I didn't know whether I could do it properly. I mean, doing a job as a part of a crew and instructing others how to do this job is a job that and I wasn't aware that I could even do it.
So, tell me about the job. How do you do it? What do you do as wireless instructor?
You get a man of your similar rank. Okay, he's already done the training for his job. But he has not done operational flying or any type of flying over the UK. Now, this is important. If you come from Canada, or you've been flying on America, or even in the UK, you have not experienced flight in all the weathers and all the knowledge of navigational aids, flight paths. All this has to be taught to, in particular, the wireless operator. He also has to know how to channel the different the different sources of information that were so different over here to what they were anywhere else. In other words, here you have the most up-to-date navigational aids by wireless, visual aids by learning what to look for, your job to aid everybody else in the aircraft. You had to teach this, okay? And you had to teach it under conditions of anything. You look in that logbook, you just flew. They worry about the weather up in Cumbria. You flew, and every time you flew over the sea, you flew over the mountains, and they didn't give a monkeys about the weather, you flew. And this is possibly the best training that a wireless op can get, because he would have all sorts of duties to do, and he would, at the end of that day, pass out and be able to go and crew up and fly. And I was probably there for, a year, and I only had one chap say to me, "I don't want to carry on." Of all the...
So, you were there roughly from January 44 through to January 45?
Yeah.
Now, what would you do? You'd go up with them, would you?
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, there's lots of flying in your log.
Yeah. You'd fly with them and do the trip, and you'd stay with them, and you'd follow that chap right the way through to the moment where he would be passed out, and you would give him that credibility as being a competent wireless operator.
Now, was there anything new coming? Because there were new navigation things.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk to a bit about them? What new ones do you remember? I mean, I don't know whether H2S came in that time.
That wouldn't be for the wireless operator anyway, okay?
So what new stuff was it coming in for you?
Well, we had different types and advanced receivers, and the same model, but there were added conveniences on there. You had a type J switch, which switched over to save you changing plugs. There was automatic systems for tuning the transmitter. And bear in mind, your job of transmitting would be only in an emergency. And you had to get into the wireless operator's natural ability to say, yeah, this is the time I transmit, is whether you transmit before you go into the sea or when you are approaching the sea or whether you're bailing out or whatever. But that information is the only information that you could give to the ground crew. And also the beacons. You see, there are flashing beacons all over the country. And these beacons would be changing all the time. They wouldn't just leave the same beacon flashing the same code all the time. They'd change them. Otherwise, the Germans would soon pick up the system. So you had to know how to read these beacons.
Now, and these, all this equipment and beacons were getting better.
Oh, yeah.
And it was getting better, because sometimes changes are not as good, but this was...
Oh, no, they were getting better. Yeah.
Now, what did you think? You were doing most of your flights in Anson's, from the looks of things. What did you think of the Anson?
Very safe, good instructional aircraft.
What made it a good instructional aircraft as opposed to operational?
Because you were sitting next to your pupil, just here. You had a seat next to him. Okay. And you would also, the pilot, you see, you would have two or three other people in the aircraft who he was instructing, the navigator and the bomb aimer.
Now, so what? So it looks to me before, when you say there's a pier where you go to
Landvog,
to Lindholm 1656 heavy conversion unit.
that was when I went on the Lancasters, but that was when I finished at Milham or Mona. When I left Milham, I went to Mona, did I not?
It's difficult to follow.
Let me tell you, I'll tell you when.
It says Mona there. Now, the next post. So you were at Milham from January 44 through to March 45. Now, what was your next post? And this is to Mona. What was that?
It's the same type of thing. It was in it was a 8 OAFU, number 8. We did the same job there.
So you're just exactly the same, only at Mona. Did you say Isle of Anglesey? Was that Anglesey?
That's right, yeah.
Anything happened there, or same aircraft?
Same aircraft, same type of job.
And that was March 45 to
April.
So just a month there.
Yeah.
Now, how did you feel about... I mean, you could see the end of the war approaching, you know?
Yeah. No.
No, you couldn't?
Oh, no, no, no. 45, you know, you can imagine that we'd had D-Day, as you know, we'd gone through that, but now you're battling the way through, and the Bomber Command were still operating, you know, still going strong.
So you were you expecting an operational posting at this time?
Yeah.
Did you want one?
Yes. Yeah. You'd had enough of that, Heather, you know.
Now, what's your next posting then?
Went to our Lindone.
Lindholm,
yeah. That was 1656 Heavy Conversion Unit.
Now, what were you doing with them?
Learning how to fly in the Lancaster.
As a wireless operator?
As a wireless op, yeah.
Now, were you forming the crew there? Or
formed a crew.
Now... do you remember what was the process? Had the process of forming a crew changed at all?
Not in the least.
So it was just you still picked yourself?
Yeah, you still found, you moseyed around and tried to get a crew that had done some operations.
Now, who was the crew you formed with? Do you remember who you piloted?
Yeah, Flight Lieutenant Cochrane.
Cochrane?
Yeah. He hadn't done any operations, but he had done something like over 1,000 hours, I think, on flying aircraft, and particularly the Lancaster. So he was a very good pilot on the Lancaster, who I chose to flow with.
Now, and what did you think of him? What was he like?
Smashing chap. Handsome. Owned a car, would you believe? Nobody had cars in those days. And... I flew with him and Jack Peaker, who was a tour expired chap. He had a DFM, so he was an officer, but he'd got his medal as an NCO.
And so you're forming that crew in April 45?
Yeah.
And what did you think of the Lancaster?
June. I didn't like it.
Now, why didn't you like it?
I don't know. I just found it was a big aeroplane, and it didn't have the feeling of the Wellington. When you fly over the Wellington, you know, you felt safe to get out of it. And I looked at the Lancaster, and I thought, well, you know, 3 foot by 2 foot, and 5 men have got to get out of that little door by one with a seat parachute. I sensed an unease about it. On the ground. But when I got in the air, okay, it was a much better aircraft, of course.
In what way? How was it better?
You could feel the power it had. You know, I mean, you really had. And you'd fly in it and see it flying on one engine, which was quite incredible, you know.